Goldfinger by Ian Fleming continued. Disc 4. Goldfinger came through and quietly closed the door behind him. He was wearing a plum-coloured velvet dinner jacket. He came slowly across the polished wood floor. He didn't hold out his hand. He said, smiling with his mouth,
"It was kind of you to come at such short notice, Mr. Bond. You were alone, and so was I, and it occurred to me that we might discuss the price of corn."
It was the sort of remark that rich men make to each other. Bond was amused at being made a temporary member of the club. He said, "I was delighted to get the invitation. I was already bored with worrying over my problems. Ramsgate hasn't much to offer."
"No. And now I have an apology to make. I have had a telephone call. One of my staff—I employ Koreans, by the way—has had some minor trouble with the Margate police, and I must go over and straighten it out. Some incident at the fun fair, I understand. These people get easily overexcited. My chauffeur will drive me, and we should not be more than half an hour. Meanwhile, I fear I must leave you to your own devices. Please help yourself to drinks. There are magazines to read. Will you forgive me? Not more than half an hour, I assure you."
"That's quite all right." Bond felt there was something fishy in this. He couldn't put his finger on what it was.
"Well then, au revoir."
Goldfinger went to the front door.
"But I must give you some light. It's really very dark in here."
Goldfinger brushed his hand down a wall plate of switches, and suddenly lights blazed all over the hall, from standard lamps, wall brackets, and four clusters in the ceiling. Now the room was as bright as a film studio. It was an extraordinary transformation. Bond, half dazzled, watched Goldfinger open the front door and stride out. In a minute he heard the sound of a car, but not the rolls, rev up noisily, change gear, and go off fast down the drive. On an instinct, Bond walked over to the front door and opened it. The drive was empty. In the distance he saw the lights of the car turn left-handed on the main road and make off in the direction of Margate. He turned back into the house and closed the door. He stood still, listening. The silence, except for the heavy clock tick, was complete. He walked across to the service door and opened it. A long, dark passage disappeared towards the back of the house. Bond bent forward, all his senses alert. Silence. Dead silence. Bond shut the door and looked thoughtfully round the brilliantly lit hall. He had been left alone in Goldfinger's house, alone with its secrets. Why? Bond walked over to the drink tray and poured himself a strong gin and tonic. There certainly had been a telephone call, but it could easily have been an arranged call from the factory. The story of the servant was plausible, and it was reasonable that Goldfinger should go himself to bail the man out and take his chauffeur with him. Goldfinger had twice mentioned that Bond would be alone for half an hour, during which he would be left to his own devices. This could be innocent, or it could be an invitation for Bond to show his hand, commit some indiscretion. Was somebody watching him? How many of these Koreans were there, and what were they doing? Bond glanced at his watch. 5 minutes had gone. He made up his mind. Trap or no trap, this was too good a chance to miss. He would have a quick look round, but an innocent one, with some sort of a cover story to explain why he had left the hall. Where should he begin? A look at the factory. His story? That his car had given trouble on the way over, choked petrol feed probably, and that he had gone to see if there was a mechanic who could give him a hand. Flimsy, but it would do. Bond downed his drink and went purposefully to the service door and walked through. There was a light switch. He turned on the light and walked swiftly down a long passage. It ended with a blank wall and two doors to right and left. He listened for an instant at the left-hand one and heard muffled kitchen noises. He opened the right-hand door and found himself in the paved garage yard he might have expected. The only odd thing about it was that it was brilliantly lit by arc lights. The long wall of the factory occupied the far side, and now the rhythmic engine thump was very loud. There was a plain wooden door low down in the wall opposite. Bond walked across the yard to it, looking around him with casual interest. The door was unlocked. He opened it with discretion and walked through, leaving the door ajar. He found himself in a small empty office, lit by one naked bulb hanging from the ceiling. There was a desk with papers on it, a time clock, a couple of filing cabinets, and a telephone. Another door led from the office into the main factory space, and there was a window beside the door for keeping an eye on the workmen. It would be the foreman's office. Bond walked to the window and looked through. Bond didn't know what he had expected, but there seemed to be the usual accoutrement of a small metalworking business. Facing him were the open mouths of two blast furnaces, their fires now drawn. Beside these stood a row of kilns for the molten metal, of which sheets of different sizes and colours stood against the wall nearby. There was the polished steel table of a circular saw, a diamond saw, presumably, for cutting the sheets, and to the left, in the shadows, a big oil engine connected to a generator pounded away making power. To the right, under arc lights, a group of five men in overalls, four of them Koreans, were at work on, of all things, Goldfinger's Rolls-Royce. It stood there, gleaming under the lights, immaculate save for the right-hand door, which had been taken off its hinges and now lay across two nearby benches, minus its door panel. As Bond watched, two men picked up the new door panel, a heavy, discoloured sheet of aluminium-coloured metal, and placed it on the door frame. There were two hand riveters on the floor, and soon, Bond thought, the men would rivet the panel into place and paint it to match the rest of the car. All perfectly innocent and above board. Goldfinger had dented the panel that afternoon, and had had a quick repair job done in preparation for his trip tomorrow. Bond gave a quick, sour look round, withdrew from the window and went out by the factory door, and closed it softly behind him. Nothing there, damn it. And now what was his story? That he had not wanted to disturb the men at their work. Perhaps after dinner, if one of them had a moment. Bond walked unhurriedly back the way he had come, and regained the hall without misadventure. Bond looked at his watch. 10 minutes to go. Now for the first floor. The secrets of a house are in the bedrooms and bathrooms. Those are the private places, where the medicine cabinets, the dressing table, the bedside drawers, reveal the intimate things, the frailties. Bond had a bad headache. He had gone to look for an aspirin. He acted the part for an invisible audience, massaged his temples, glanced up at the gallery, walked decisively across the floor and climbed the stairs. The gallery gave onto a brightly lit passage. Bond walked down it, opening the doors and glancing in, but they were spare bedrooms, the beds not made up. They held a smell of must and shut windows. A large ginger cat appeared from nowhere and followed him, mewing and rubbing itself against his trouser legs. The end room was the one. Bond went in and closed the door to a crack. All the lights were on. Perhaps one of the servants was in the bathroom. Bond walked boldly across to the communicating door and opened it. More lights, but no one. It was a big bathroom, probably a spare room converted into a bathroom, and, in addition to the bath and lavatory, it held various fitness machines, a rowing machine, a fixed bicycle wheel, Indian clubs, and a rally health belt. The medicine cabinet contained nothing except a great variety of purges, Cenopods, Cascara, Calcellets, Enos, and various apparatus for the same purpose. There were no other drugs, and no aspirin. Bond went back into the bedroom and again drew a blank. It was a typical man's room, comfortable, lived in, with plenty of fitted cupboards. It even smelled neutral. There was a small bookcase beside the bed in which all the books were history or biography, all in English. The drawer of the bedside table yielded a solitary indiscretion, a yellow-backed copy of The Hidden Sight of Love, Palladium Publications, Paris. Bond glanced at his watch. 5 more minutes. It was time to go. He took a last look round the room and moved to the door. Suddenly he stopped. What was it he had noticed almost subconsciously ever since he had come into the room? He sharpened his senses. There was an incongruity somewhere. What was it? A colour? An object? A smell? A sound? That was it. From where he stood, he could hear the faintest mosquito-shrill whine. It was almost extrasensory in its pitch. Where did it come from? What was making it? Now there was something else in the room, something that Bond knew all too well, the smell of danger. Tensely, Bond stepped closer to the fitted cupboard beside the door, softly opened it. Yes, it came from inside the cupboard, from behind a range of sports coats that reached down to the top of three banks of drawers. Sharply, Bond swept the coats aside, his jaws clenched at what was behind them. From three slots near the top of the cupboard, 16mm film was inching down in three separate strips into a deep bin behind the false front of the drawers. The bin was almost half full of the slimy snakes of the stuff. Bond's eyes narrowed tensely as he watched the damning evidence coil slowly down onto the pile. So that was it. Cine cameras, three of them, their lenses concealed God knows where, in the hall, in the garage courtyard, in this room, had been watching his every move from the moment Goldfinger had left the house, switching on the cameras, and, of course, the dazzling lights, as he went out of the door. Why hadn't Bond seen the significance of those lights? Why hadn't he had the elementary imagination to see the trap as well as smell it? Cover stories, indeed. What use were they now, when he had spent half an hour snooping round and finding nothing for his pains? That, too. He had discovered nothing, unearthed no secret. It had all been an idiotic waste of time, and now Goldfinger had him. Now he was finished, hopelessly blown. Was there any way of saving something from the wreckage? Bond stood riveted, staring at the slow cataracts of film. Let's see now. Bond's mind raced, thinking of ways out, excuses, discarding them all. Well, at least by opening the cupboard door he had exposed some of the film. Then why not expose it all? Why not? But how? How could the open cupboard door be explained except by his doing? There came a meow from the open slit of the bedroom door. The cat. Why shouldn't the cat have done it? Pretty thin, but at least it was the shadow of an alibi. Bond opened the door. He picked the cat up in his arms. He went back with it to the cupboard, stroking it brusquely. It purred. Bond leant over the bin of film, picking it up in handfuls, so that it would all get the light. Then, when he was satisfied that it must be ruined, he tossed it back and dropped the cat in on top of it. The cat would not be able to get out easily. With any luck, it would settle down and go to sleep. Bond left the cupboard door 3 inches ajar to spoil the continuing film, and the bedroom door the same amount, and ran down the passage. At the top of the stairs he slowed and sauntered down. The empty hall yawned at his play-acting. He walked across to the fireplace, dashed more drink into his glass, and picked up the field. He turned to the golf commentary by Bernard Darwin, ran his eye down it to see what it was about, and then settled into one of the club chairs and lit a cigarette. What had he found out? What was there on the plus side? Precious little, except that Goldfinger suffered from constipation and a dirty mind, and that he had wanted to put Bond through an elementary test. He had certainly done it expertly. This was no amateur. The technique was fully up to Smersh standards, and it was surely the technique of somebody with a very great deal to hide. And now what would happen? For the cat alibi to stand up, Goldfinger would have to have left 2 doors, one of them vital, ajar, and the cat had got into the room and been intrigued by the whine of the cameras. Most unlikely. Almost incredible. Goldfinger would be 90% certain it was Bond, but only 90. There would still be that 10% of uncertainty. Would Goldfinger have learnt much more than he knew before? That Bond was a tricky, resourceful customer, and that Bond had been inquisitive, might be a thief. He would guess Bond had been to the bedroom, but Bond's other movements, for whatever they were worth, would remain a secret on the exposed film. Bond got up and took a handful of other magazines and threw them down beside his chair. The only thing for him to do was brazen it out and make a note for the future, if there was to be a future, that he had better wake his ideas up and not make any more mistakes. There wouldn't be enough ginger cats in the world to help him out of one more tight spot like the one he was in. There had been no noise of a car coming down the drive, not a sound from the door. But Bond felt the evening breeze on his neck, and he knew that Goldfinger had come back into the room. Chapter 11. The Odd Job Man. Bond threw down the field and stood up. The front door closed noisily. Bond turned. "Hello." His face registered polite surprise. "Didn't hear you arrive. How did it go?" Goldfinger's expression was equally bland. They might have been old friends, neighbours in the country, who were accustomed to drop in on each other for a drink. "Oh, it sorted itself out. My chap had had a row in a pub with some American Air Force men, who had called him a bloody Jap. I explained to the police that Koreans don't like being called Japs. They let him off with a caution. Terribly sorry to have been so long. Hope you weren't bored. Do have another drink." "Thanks. But it's hardly seemed 5 minutes since you left." Been reading what Darwin has to say about the 14 club rule. Interesting point of view. Bond launched into a detailed review of the article, adding his own comments on the rule. Goldfinger stood patiently until it was over. He said,
"Yes, it's a complicated business. Of course you play rather a different game from me, more workmanlike. With my kind of swing, I find I need all the clubs I'm allowed. Well, I'll just go up and wash, and then we'll have dinner. Shan't be a moment."
Bond busied himself noisily with pouring another drink, sat down and picked up Country Life. He watched Goldfinger climb the stairs and disappear down the corridor. He could visualize every step. He found he was reading the periodical upside down. He turned it round and stared blindly at a fine photograph of Blenheim Palace. There was dead silence upstairs. Then a distant lavatory chain was pulled and a door clicked shut. Bond reached for his drink, took a deep swallow and put the glass down beside his chair. Goldfinger was coming down the stairs. Bond turned the pages of Country Life and flicked ash off his cigarette into the grate. Now Goldfinger was crossing the floor towards him. Bond lowered his paper and looked up. Goldfinger was carrying the ginger cat tucked carelessly under one arm. He reached the fireplace, bent forward, and pressed the bell. He turned towards Bond.
"Do you like cats?"
His gaze was flat, incurious. "Sufficiently." The service door opened. The chauffeur stood in the frame. He still wore his bowler hat and his shiny black gloves. He gazed impassively at Goldfinger. Goldfinger crooked a finger. The chauffeur approached and stood within the circle by the fire. Goldfinger turned to Bond. He said conversationally,
"This is my handyman." He smiled thinly. "That is something of a joke. Odd job. Show Mr. Bond your hands."
He smiled again at Bond.
"I call him Odd Job because that describes his functions on my staff."
The Korean slowly pulled off his gloves and came and stood at arm's length from Bond and held out his hands, palm upwards. Bond got up and looked at them. They were big and fat with muscle. The fingers all seemed to be the same length. They were very blunt at the tips, and the tips glinted as if they were made of yellow bone.
"Turn them over and show Mr. Bond the sides."
There were no fingernails. Instead, there was this same yellowish carapace. The man turned the hands sideways. Down each edge of the hands was a hard ridge of the same bony substance. Bond raised his eyebrows at Goldfinger.
Goldfinger said, "We will have a demonstration."
He pointed at the thick oak banisters that ran up the stairs. The rail was a massive 6 inches by 4 thick. The Korean obediently walked over to the stairs and climbed a few steps. He stood with his hands at his sides, gazing across at Goldfinger like a good retriever. Goldfinger gave a quick nod. Impassively, the Korean lifted his right hand high and straight above his head and brought the side of it down like an axe across the heavy, polished rail. There was a splintering crash, and the rail sagged, broken through the center. Again the hand went up and flashed down. This time it swept right through the rail, leaving a jagged gap. Splinters clattered down onto the floor of the hall. The Korean straightened himself and stood to attention, waiting for further orders. There was no flush of effort in his face, and no hint of pride in his achievement. Goldfinger beckoned. The man came back across the floor. Goldfinger said,
"His feet are the same, the outside edges of them. Odd job. The mantelpiece."
Goldfinger pointed at the heavy shelf of carved wood above the fireplace. It was about 7 feet off the ground, 6 inches higher than the top of the Korean's bowler hat.
"Garchahar?"
"Yes. Take off your coat and hat." Goldfinger turned to Bond. "Poor chap's got a cleft palate. I shouldn't think there are many people who understand him beside me."
Bond reflected how useful that would be, a slave who could only communicate with the world through his interpreter, better even than the deaf mutes of the harems, more tightly bound to his master, more secure. Odd Job had taken off his coat and hat and placed them neatly on the floor. Now he rolled his trouser legs up to the knee and stood back in the wide, well-planted stance of the judo expert. He looked as if a charging elephant wouldn't put him off balance.
"Better stand back, Mr. Bond."
The teeth glittered in the wide mouth.
"This blow snaps a man's neck like a daffodil."
Goldfinger drew aside the low settee with the drink tray. Now the Korean had a clear run, but he was only 3 long steps away. How could he possibly reach the high mantelpiece? Bond watched, fascinated. Now the slanting eyes in the flat yellow mask were glinting with a fierce intentness. Faced by such a man, thought Bond, one could only go down on one's knees and wait for death. Goldfinger lifted his hand. The bunched toes in the polished soft leather shoes seemed to grip the ground. The Korean took one long, crouching stride with knees well bent, and then whirled off the ground. In midair his feet slapped together like a ballet dancer's, but higher than a ballet dancer's have ever reached, and then the body bent sideways and downwards, and the right foot shot out like a piston. There came a crashing thud. Gracefully, the body settled back down on the hands, now splayed on the floor, the elbows bent to take the weight, and then straightened sharply to throw the man up and back on his feet. Oddjob stood to attention. This time there was a gleam of triumph in his flat eyes as he looked at the 3-inch jagged bite the edge of his foot had taken out of the mantelpiece.
But, as you can imagine, that blow would have smashed a man's skull or half-severed his neck. A homely and a most ingeniously concealed weapon, I'm sure you'll agree.
Yes, indeed. Bond smiled with equal politeness. A useful chap to have around. Oddjob had picked up his hat and disappeared. There came the boom of a gong.
Ah, dinner. Shall we go in?
Goldfinger led the way to a door concealed in the panelling to the right of the fireplace. He pressed a hidden latch and they walked through. The small dining room matched the heavy wealth of the hall. It was brilliantly lit from a central chandelier and by candles on a round table that glittered with silver and glass. They sat down opposite each other. 2 yellow-faced servants in white mess jackets brought dishes from a loaded serving table. The first course was some curried mess with rice. Goldfinger noticed Bond's hesitation. He gave a dry chuckle.
"It's all right, Mr. Bond. Shrimp, not the cat."
"Ah." Bond's expression was non-committal.
"Please try the Moselle. I hope it will be to your taste. It is a Peace Porter Goldtrufchen, 53. Help yourself. These people are as likely to pour it into your plate as your glass."
There was a slim bottle in an ice bucket in front of Bond. He poured some of the wine and tasted it. It was nectar and ice cold. Bond congratulated his host. Goldfinger gave a curt nod.
"I don't myself drink or smoke, Mr. Bond. Smoking I find the most ridiculous of all the varieties of human behaviour, and practically the only one that is entirely against nature. Can you imagine a cow or any animal taking a mouthful of smouldering straw, then breathing in the smoke and blowing it out through his nostrils? Pah!"
Goldfinger showed a rare trace of emotion.
"It is a vile practice. As for drinking, I am something of a chemist, and I have yet to find a liquor that is free from traces of a number of poisons, some of them deadly, such as fusel oil, acetic acid, ethyl acetate, acetaldehyde, and furfural. A quantity of some of these poisons taken neat would kill you. In the small amounts you find in a bottle of liquor, they produce various ill effects, most of which are lightly written off as a hangover."
Goldfinger paused with a fork full of curried shrimp halfway to his mouth.
"Since you are a drinker, Mr. Bond, I will give you one word of good advice. Never drink so-called Napoleon brandy, particularly when it is described as aged in the wood. That particular potion contains more of the poisons I have mentioned than any other liquor I have analyzed. Old Bourbon comes next."
Goldfinger closed his animadversions with a mouthful of shrimp. "Thank you. I'll remember. Perhaps for those reasons I have recently taken to vodka. They tell me its filtration through activated charcoal is a help." Bond, dredging this piece of expertise out of dim recollections of something he had read, was rather proud of having been able to return Goldfinger's powerful serve. Goldfinger glanced at him sharply.
"You seem to understand something of these matters. Have you studied chemistry?"
"Only dabbled in it." It was time to move on. "I was very impressed by that chauffeur of yours. Where did he learn that fantastic combat stuff? Where did it come from? Is that what the Koreans use?" Goldfinger patted his mouth with his napkin. He snapped his fingers. The 2 men cleared away the plates and brought roast duckling and a bottle of Mouton Rothschild 1947 for Bond. When they had withdrawn into immobility at each end of the serving table, Goldfinger said,
"Have you ever heard of karate?" "No. Well, that man is one of the three in the world who have achieved the black belt in karate. Karate is a branch of judo, but it is to judo what a Spandau is to a catapult.
I could see that.
The demonstration was an elementary one. Mr. Bond,
Goldfinger held up the drumstick he had been gnawing,
I can tell you that if Odd Job had used the appropriate single blow on any one of 7 points on your body, you would now be dead.
Goldfinger bit at the side of the drumstick with relish. Bond said seriously, That's interesting. I only know 5 ways of killing Odd Job with one blow. Goldfinger seemed not to hear the comment. He put down his drumstick and took a deep draught of water. He sat back and spoke while Bond went on eating the excellent food.
Karate, Mr. Bond, is based on the theory that the human body possesses 5 striking surfaces and 37 vulnerable spots. Vulnerable, that is, to an expert in karate, whose fingertips, the side of the hands, and the feet are hardened into layers of corn, which is far stronger and more flexible than bone. Every day of his life, Mr. Bond, Odd Job spends 1 hour hitting either sacks of unpolished rice or a strong post whose top is wound many times round with thick rope. He then spends another hour at physical training, which is more that of a ballet school than of a gymnasium.
When does he practice tossing the bowler hat? Bond had no intention of succumbing to this psychological warfare. Goldfinger frowned at the interruption.
I have never inquired, he said without humour. But I think you can take it that Odd Job keeps his eye in at all his skills. However, you are asking where karate originated. It originated in China, where wandering Buddhist priests became an easy prey for footpads and bandits. Their religion did not allow them to carry weapons, so they developed their own form of unarmed combat. The inhabitants of Okinawa refined the art to its present form when the Japanese forbade them to carry weapons. They developed the 5 striking surfaces of the human body, the fist, the edge of the hand, the fingertips, the ball of the foot, and the elbows, and toughened them until they were enveloped in layers of corn. There is no follow-through in a karate blow. The entire body is stiffened at the moment of impact, with the emphasis on the hips, and then instantly relaxed so that balance is never lost. It is astonishing what Odd Job can do. I have seen him hit a brick wall with his entire force and not hurt his hand. He can split 3 half-inch thick boards piled one upon the other with 1 blow of his hand. You have seen what he can do with his foot.
Bond took a deep draught of the delicious claret. All this must be rather hard on your furniture. Goldfinger shrugged.
I have no more use for this house. I thought a demonstration would amuse you. I hope you agree that Odd Job earned his cat.
The X-ray eyes blazed briefly across the table. Does he train on cats?
He regards them as a great delicacy. He acquired the taste during a famine in his country when he was young.
Bond thought it was time to delve rather more deeply. Why do you need such a man? He can't be very good company.
Mr. Bond.
Goldfinger snapped his fingers for the 2 servants.
It happens that I am a rich man, a very rich man, and the richer the man, the more he needs protection. The ordinary bodyguard or detective is usually a retired policeman. Such men are valueless. Their reactions are slow, their methods old-fashioned, and they are open to bribery. Moreover, they have a respect for human life. That is no good if I wish to stay alive. The Koreans have no such feelings. That is why the Japanese employed them as guards for their prison camps during the war. They are the cruelest, most ruthless people in the world. My own staff are hand-picked for these qualities. They have served me well. I have no complaints, nor have they. They are well-paid and well-fed and housed. When they want women, street women are brought down from London, well-remunerated for their services, and sent back. The women are not much to look at, but they are white, and that is all the Koreans ask, to submit the white race to the grossest indignities. There are sometimes accidents, but...
The pale eyes gazed blankly down the table.
Money is an effective winding sheet.
Bond smiled.
You like the aphorism? It is my own.
An excellent cheese soufflé came and was followed by coffee. They ate in silence, both apparently comfortable and relaxed by these confidences. Bond certainly was. Goldfinger, obviously by design, was letting his hair down. Not far, not farther than his shoulders, but he was showing Bond one of his private faces, presumably the one to which he thought Bond would respond, the ruthlessly efficient, cold-blooded tycoon. Perhaps, after all, Bond's spying in the house, which Goldfinger must at least presume, had revealed something about Bond that Goldfinger was pleased to know, that Bond had a crooked side to him, that he wasn't a gentleman in more than appearance. Now there should be more probing, and then, with luck, the proposition would follow. Bond sat back and lit a cigarette. He said, "That's a beautiful car you've got. Must be about the last of the series. About 1925, wasn't it? Two blocks of three cylinders with two plugs for each cylinder, one set fired from the mag and the other from the coil."
"You are correct. But in other respects I have had to introduce some modifications. I have added five leaves to the springs and fitted disc brakes to the rear wheels to increase the braking power. The servo-operated front-wheel brakes were not sufficient."
"Oh, why not? The top speed wouldn't be more than 50. The body can't be all that heavy." Goldfinger raised his eyebrows.
"You think not? 1 ton of armor plating and armor-plated glass make a big difference."
Bond smiled. "Ah, I see. You certainly do take good care of yourself. But how does that work flying the channel? Doesn't the car go through the floor of the plane?"
"I take a plane to myself. The Silver City Company knows the car. It is a regular routine, twice a year."
"Just touring round Europe?"
"A golfing holiday."
"Great fun. Always wanted to do it myself." Goldfinger didn't take the bait.
"You can afford to now."
Bond smiled. "Oh, that extra $10,000. But I may need that if I decide to move to Canada."
"You think you could make money there? Do you want to make a lot of money?"
Bond's voice was eager. "Very much. There's no other point in working."
"Unfortunately, most ways of making big money take a long time. By the time one has made the money, one is too old to enjoy it."
"That's the trouble. I'm always on the lookout for shortcuts. You won't find them here. Taxation's too heavy."
"Quite. And the laws are strict."
"Yes, I found that out."
"Indeed?"
"Got on the fringe of the heroin racket. Only just got out without burning my fingers. Of course this'll go no further." Goldfinger shrugged his shoulders.
"Mr. Bond, someone said that law is the crystallized prejudices of the community. I agree with that definition. It happens to apply most strongly to the traffic in drugs. Even if it didn't, I am not concerned with assisting the police."
"Well, it was like this." Bond launched into the story of the Mexican traffic, swapping roles with Blackwell. He ended up, "I was lucky to get away with it, but it didn't make me particularly popular with Universal Export."
"I dare say not. An interesting story. You seem to have shown resource. You are not tempted to continue in the same line of business?"
Bond shrugged his shoulders. "A bit too tricky. To judge by this Mexican, the big men in the business aren't quite big enough when it comes to the pinch. When things got tough, he didn't fight back, except with his mouth."
"Well, Mr. Bond..."
Goldfinger got up from the table and Bond followed suit.
"It's been an interesting evening. I don't know that I would go back into heroin. There are safer ways of making big money. You want to be certain that the odds are right, and then you should hazard everything. Doubling one's money isn't easy, and the chances don't occur frequently. You would like to hear another of my aphorisms?"
"Yes."
"Well, Mr. Bond..."
Goldfinger gave the rich man's thin smile.
"The safest way to double your money is fold it twice and put it in your pocket."
Bond, the bank clerk hearkening to the bank manager, smiled dutifully but made no comment. This just wasn't good enough. He was getting nowhere. But instinct told him not to put his foot down on the accelerator. They went back into the hall. Bond held out his hand. "Well, many thanks for the excellent dinner. Time I went and got some sleep. Perhaps we shall run into each other again some day." Goldfinger pressed Bond's hand briefly and pushed it away from him. It was another mannerism of the millionaire subconsciously afraid of the touch. He looked hard at Bond. He said enigmatically,
"I shouldn't be at all surprised, Mr. Bond."
On his way across the Isle of Thanet, in the moonlight, Bond turned the phrase over and over in his mind. He undressed and got into bed, thinking of it, unable to guess its significance. It could mean that Goldfinger intended to get in touch with Bond, or it could mean that Bond must try and keep in touch with Goldfinger. Heads the former, tails the latter. Bond got out of bed and took a coin from the dressing table and tossed it. It came down tails. So it was up to him to keep close to Goldfinger. So be it. But his cover would have to be pretty darn good the next time they ran into each other. Bond got back into bed and was instantly asleep.
Chapter 12. Long Tail on a Ghost. Punctually at 9 the next morning, Bond got onto the Chief of Staff. "James here. I've had a look at the property, been all over it, had dinner last night with the owner. I can say pretty well for certain that the managing director's view is right. Something definitely wrong about the property. Not enough facts to send you on a surveyor's report. Owner's going abroad tomorrow, flying from Ferryfield. Wish I knew his departure time. Like to have another sight of his rolls. Thought I'd make him a present of a portable wireless set. I'll be going over a bit later in the day. Could you get Miss Ponsonby to book me? Destination unknown for the present. I'll be keeping in touch. Anything your end?"
"How did the game of golf go?"
"I won." There was a chuckle at the other end.
"Thought you had. Pretty big stakes, weren't they?"
"How did you know?"
"Had Mr. Scotland on last night. Said he'd had a tip on the telephone that someone of your name was in possession of a large amount of undeclared dollars. Had we got such a person, and was it true? Chap wasn't very senior and didn't know about Universal. Told him to have a word with the commissioner, and we got an apology this morning about the same time as your secretary found an envelope containing $10,000 in your mail. Pretty sly of your man, wasn't it?"
Bond smiled. Typical of Goldfinger to have thought of a way of getting him into trouble over the dollars. Probably he made the call to Scotland Yard directly after the game. He had wanted to show Bond that if you gave Goldfinger a knock, you'd get at least a thorn in your hand. But the Universal Export cover seemed to have stuck. Bond said, "That's pretty hot. The Twister. You might tell the managing director that this time it goes to the White Cross. Can you fix the other things?"
"Of course. Call you back in a few minutes. But watch your step abroad and call us at once if you get bored and need company. So long."
"Bye." Bond put down the receiver. He got up and set about packing his bag. He could see the scene in the Chief of Staff's office as the conversation was played back off the tape while the Chief of Staff translated the call to Miss Moneypenny.
"Says he agrees that Goldfinger is up to something big, but he can't make out what. G is flying this morning with his rolls from Ferryfield. 007 wants to follow. Let's say 2 hours later to let G get well away on the other side. Fix the reservation, would you? He wants us to have a word with customs, so that he can take a good look at the rolls and plant a homer in the boot. Fix that too, please. He'll keep in touch through stations in case he needs help."
And so forth. It was an efficient machine. Bond finished packing, and when the London call came, giving him his various clearances, he went downstairs, paid his bill, and got quickly out of Ramsgate onto the Canterbury Road. London had said that Goldfinger was booked on a special flight leaving at 12. Bond got to Ferryfield by 11, made himself known to the chief passport control and the customs officers who were expecting him, had his car taken out of sight into an empty hangar, and sat and smoked and talked minor shop with the passport men. They thought he was from Scotland Yard. He let them go on thinking it. "No," he said, "Goldfinger was all right. It was possible that one of his servants was trying to smuggle something out of the country. Rather confidential. If Bond could just be left alone with the car for 10 minutes... He wanted to have a look at the tool kit. Would the customs give the rest of the rolls their grade A going over for hidden compartments? They'd be glad to do so. At 11:45, one of the customs men put his head round the door. He winked at Bond. "Coming in now. Chauffeur on board. Going to ask both to board the plane before the car. Tell them it's something to do with the weight distribution. Not so phony as it sounds. We know this old crate. She's armour-plated. Weighs about 3 tons. Call you when we're ready." "Thanks." The room emptied. Bond took the fragile little parcel out of his pocket. It contained a dry cell battery wired to a small vacuum tube. He ran his eye over the wiring and put the apparatus back in his coat pocket and waited. At 11:55 the door opened. The officer beckoned. "No trouble. They're on the plane." The huge, gleaming silver ghost stood in the customs bay out of sight of the plane. The only other car was a dove-grey Triumph TR3 convertible with its hood down. Bond went to the back of the rolls. The customs men had unscrewed the plate of the spare tool compartment. Bond pulled out the tray of tools and made a show of minutely examining them and the tray. He knelt down. Under cover of rummaging at the sides of the compartment, he slipped the battery and tube into the back of it. He replaced the tool tray. It fitted all right. He stood up and brushed his hands together. "Negative," he said to the customs officer. The officer fitted the plate on and screwed it down with a square key. He stood up. "Nothing funny about the chassis or the bodywork. Plenty of room in the frame and upholstery, but we couldn't get at them without doing a major job. All right to go?" "Yes, and thanks." Bond walked back into the office. He heard the quick, solid whine of the old self-starter. A minute later, the car came out of the bay and idled superbly over to the loading ramp. Bond stood at the back of the office and watched it being eased up the ramp. The big jaws of the Bristol freighter clanged shut. The chocks were jerked away and the dispatcher raised a thumb. The two engines coughed heavily and fired, and the great silver dragonfly trundled off towards the runway. When the plane was on the runway, Bond walked round to his car and climbed into the driver's seat. He pressed a switch under the dash. There was a moment's silence, then a loud, harsh howl came from the hidden loudspeaker. Bond turned a knob. The howl diminished to a deep drone. Bond waited until he heard the Bristol take off. As the plane rose and made for the coast, the drone diminished. In 5 minutes it had gone. Bond tuned the set and picked it up again. He followed it for 5 minutes as the plane made off across the channel and then switched the set off. He motored round to the customs bay, told the AA that he would be back at 1:30 for the 2 o'clock flight, and drove slowly off towards a pub he knew in Rye. From now on, so long as he kept within about 100 miles of the Rolls, the Homer, the rough radio transmitter he had slipped into its tool compartment, would keep contact with Bond's receiver. All he had to do was watch the decibels and not allow the noise to fade. It was a simple form of direction-finding which allowed one car to put a long tail on another and keep in touch without any danger of being spotted. On the other side of the channel, Bond would have to discover the road Goldfinger had taken out of Latuque, get well within range and close up near big towns or wherever there was a major fork or crossroads. Sometimes Bond would make a wrong decision and have to do some fast motoring to catch up again. The DB3 would look after that. It was going to be fun playing hare and hounds across Europe. The sun was shining out of a clear sky. Bond felt a moment's sharp thrill down his spine. He smiled to himself, a hard, cold, cruel smile. "Goldfinger," he thought. "For the first time in your life, you're in trouble. Bad trouble." There is always an agent cycliste at the dangerous crossroads where Latuque's quiet N38 meets the oily turbulence of the major N1. Yes, certainly he had seen the Rolls. One could not fail to remark it. A real aristocrat of a car. To the right, monsieur, towards Abbeville. He will be an hour ahead, but with that bolide of yours. As soon as Bond had cleared his papers at the airport, the Homer had picked up the drone of the Rolls. But it was impossible to tell if Goldfinger was heading north, for the Low Countries, or Austria or Germany, or if he was off to the south. For that sort of fix you needed 2 radio cars to get a bearing. Bond raised a hand to the agent and gave his engine the gun. He would have to close up fast. Goldfinger would be through Abbeville and would already have taken the major fork onto N1 for Paris or N28 for Rouen. A lot of time and distance would be wasted if Bond made the wrong guess. Bond swept along the badly cambered road. He took no chances, but covered the 43 kilometres to Abbeville in a quarter of an hour. The drone of the Homer was loud. Goldfinger couldn't be more than 20 miles ahead, but which way at the fork? On a guess, Bond took the Paris road. He beat the car along. For a time there was little change in the voice of the Homer. Bond could be right or wrong. Then, imperceptibly, the drone began to fade. Blast! Turn back or press on fast and take one of the secondary roads across to Rouen and catch up with him there. Bond hated turning back. 10 kilometres short of Beauvais, he turned right. For a time it was bad going, but then he was on to the fast N30 and could afford to drift into Rouen, led on by the beckoning voice of his pickup. He stopped on the outskirts of the town and listened with one ear while consulting his Michelin. By the waxing drone he could tell that he had got ahead of Goldfinger. But now there was another vital fork, not quite so easy to retrieve if Bond guessed wrong again. Either Goldfinger would take the Alençon-Le Mans-Tour route to the south, or he meant to move southeast, missing Paris, by way of Evreux, Chartres, and Orléans. Bond couldn't afford to get closer to the centre of Rouen, and perhaps catch a glimpse of the Rolls and of the way it would take. He would have to wait until the Homer went on the wane, and then make his own guess. It was a quarter of an hour later before Bond could be sure that the Rolls was well past. This time he again took the left leg of the fork. He thrust the pedal into the floor and hurried. Yes. This time the drone was merging into a howl. Bond was on the track. He slowed to 40, tuned down his receiver to a whisper, and idled along, wondering where Goldfinger was heading for. 5 o'clock. 6. 7. The sun set in Bond's driving mirror, and still the Royals sped on. They were through Dreux and Chartres, and onto the long, straight 50-mile stretch into Orléans. If that was to be the night stop, the Royals wouldn't have done badly at all. Over 250 miles in something over 6 hours. Goldfinger was certainly no slouch when it came to motoring. He must be keeping the old Silver Ghost at maximum outside the towns. Bond began to close up. There were rear lights ahead, dim ones. Bond had his fog lights on. He switched on the marshals. It was some little sports car. Bond closed up. MG, Triumph, Austin Healey. It was a pale grey Triumph two-seater with the hood up. Bond blinked his lights and swept past. Now there was the glare of another car ahead. Bond doused his headlamps and drove on the fogs. The other car was a mile down the road. Bond crept up on it. At a quarter of a mile he flashed the marshals on and off for a quick look. Yes, it was the Rolls. Bond dropped back to a mile and stayed there, vaguely noticing the dim lights of the TR-3 in his mirror. On the outskirts of Orléans, Bond pulled into the side of the road. The Triumph growled casually past. Bond had never cared for Orléans. It was a priest and myth-ridden town without charm or gaiety. It was content to live off Joan of Arc and give the visitor a hard, holy glare while it took his money. Bond consulted his Michelin. Goldfinger would stop at 5-star hotels and eat fillets of sole and roast chicken. It would be the arcades for him, perhaps the moderne. Bond would have liked to stay outside the town and sleep on the banks of the Loire in the excellent Auberge de la Montespan, his belly full of quenelle de brochet. He would have to stick closer to his fox. He decided on the Hôtel de la Gare and dinner at the station buffet. When in doubt, Bond always chose the station hotels. They were adequate. There was plenty of room to park the car, and it was better than even chances that the Buffet de la Gare would be excellent. And at the station one could hear the heartbeat of the town. The night sounds of the trains were full of its tragedy and romance. The drone on the receiver had stayed constant for 10 minutes. Bond noted his way to the three hotels and cautiously crept into the town. He went down to the river and along the lighted quay. He had been right. The Rolls was outside the arcades. Bond turned back into the town and made for the station. The Hôtel de la Gare was all he had expected, cheap, old-fashioned, solidly comfortable. Bond had a hot bath, went back to his car to make sure the Rolls hadn't moved, and walked into the station restaurant and ate one of his favourite meals, 2 œufs cocottes à la crème, a large sole meunière. Orléans was close enough to the sea. The fish of the Loire are inclined to be muddy. And an adequate camembert. He drank a well-iced pint of Rosé d'Anjou and had a Hennessy's 3-star with his coffee. At 10:30 he left the restaurant, checked on the Rolls, and walked the virtuous streets for an hour. One more check on the Rolls, and bed. At 6 o'clock the next morning the Rolls hadn't moved. Bond paid his bill, had a café complet, with a double ration of coffee at the station, motored down to the quay, and backed his car up a side street. This time he could not afford to make a mistake. Goldfinger would either cross the river and head south to join N7 for the Riviera, or he would follow the north bank of the Loire, also perhaps for the Riviera, but also on the route for Switzerland and Italy. Bond got out of the car and lounged against the parapet of the river wall, watching between the trunks of the plane trees. At 8:30 two small figures came out of the arcades. The Rolls moved off. Bond watched it follow the quay until it was out of sight, then he got behind the wheel of the Aston Martin and set off in pursuit. Bond motored comfortably along the Loire in the early summer sunshine. This was one of his favourite corners of the world. In May, with the fruit trees burning white and the soft, wide river still big with the winter rains, the valley was green and young and dressed for love. He was thinking this when, before Châteauneuf, there was a shrill scream from twin Bosch horns and the little Triumph tore past. The hood was down. There was the blur of a pretty face hidden by white motoring goggles with dark blue lenses. Although Bond only saw the edge of a profile, a slash of red mouth and the fluttering edge of black hair under a pink handkerchief with white spots, he knew she was pretty from the way she held her head. There was the authority of someone who is used to being admired, combined with the self-consciousness of a girl driving alone and passing a man in a smart car. Bond thought, that would happen today. The Loire is dressed for just that, chasing that girl until you run her to ground at lunchtime, the contact at the empty restaurant by the river, out in the garden under the vine trellis, the friture and the ice-cold Vouvray, the cautious sniffing at each other, and then the two cars motoring on in convoy until that evening, well down to the south, there would be the place they had agreed on at lunch, olive trees, crickets singing in the indigo dusk, the discovery that they liked each other, and that their destinations could wait. Then next day, no, not tonight, I don't know you well enough, and besides, I'm tired. They would leave her car in the hotel garage and go off in his at a tangent, slowly, knowing there was no hurry for anything, driving to the west, away from the big roads. What was that place he had always wanted to go to, simply because of the name? Yes, Entre deux Seines, a village near Les Baux. Perhaps there wasn't even an inn there. Well, then they would go to Les Baux itself, at the Bouches du Rhône, on the edge of the Camargue. There they would take adjoining rooms, not a double room, it would be too early for that, in the fabulous Beaumanière, the only hotel-restaurant in France with Michelin's supreme accolade. They would eat the gratin de langouste, and perhaps, because it was traditional on such a night, drink champagne. And then... Bond smiled at his story and at the dots that ended it. Not today. Today you're working. Today is for Goldfinger, not for love. Today the only scent you may smell is Goldfinger's expensive aftershave lotion, not... What would she use? English girls made mistakes about scent. He hoped it would be something slight and clean. Balmain's Vent Vert, perhaps, or Caron's Mouguet. Bond tuned up his receiver for reassurance, then hushed it and motored on, relaxed, playing with his thoughts of the girl, filling in the details. Of course he might meet up with her again. They seemed to be keeping pretty close company. She must have spent the night in Orléans. Where? What a waste. But wait a minute. Suddenly Bond woke up from his daydreaming. The open hood reminded him. He'd seen that triumph before. It had been at Ferryfield. Must have taken the flight after Goldfinger. It was true he hadn't seen the girl or noted the registration number, but surely it was the same. If so, for her to be still on Goldfinger's tail after 300 miles was more than coincidence. And she had been driving with dimmed lights the night before. Here, what's going on? Bond stepped on the accelerator. He was approaching Nevers. He'd anyway have to close up for the next big turning. He would kill two birds with one stone and also see what the girl was up to. If she was keeping station somewhere between him and Goldfinger, there would have to be some furious thinking. And it would be a blasted nuisance. It was hard enough keeping up with Goldfinger. With another tail sandwiched between them, it would become hellish difficult. She was still there, perhaps 2 miles behind the rolls, keeping well back. As soon as he caught sight of her little glittering rump, as he described it to himself, Bond slowed. Well, well, who was she? What the hell was all this about? Bond motored on, his face morose and thoughtful. The little convoy kept on, still following the wide black sheen of N7 that runs like a thick, dangerous nerve down through the heart of France. But at Moulins, Bond nearly lost the scent. He had to double back quickly and get on to N73. Goldfinger had turned at right angles and was now making for Lyon and Italy, or for Mâcon and Geneva. Bond had to do some fast motoring and then was only just in time to avoid running into trouble. He had not worried much about the pitch of the Homer. He had counted on a sight of the triumph to slow him down. Suddenly he realized that the drone was becoming a howl. If he hadn't braked hard down from the 90 he was doing, he would have been on top of the rolls. As it was, he was barely creeping along when he came over a rise and saw the big yellow car stopped by the wayside a mile ahead. There was a blessed cart track. Bond swerved into it and stopped under cover of a low hedge. He took a small pair of binoculars out of the glove compartment, got out of the car and walked back. Yes, damn it. Goldfinger was sitting below a small bridge on the bank of a stream. He was wearing a white dust coat and white linen driving helmet in the style of German tourists. He was eating, having a picnic. The sight made Bond hungry. What about his own lunch? He examined the rolls. Through the rear window he could see part of the Korean's black shape in the front seat. There was no sign of the triumph. If the girl had still been on Goldfinger's tail, she would have had no warning. She would have just kept her head down and stepped on the gas. Now she would be somewhere ahead, waiting in ambush for the rolls to come by. Or would she? Perhaps Bond's imagination had run away with him. She was probably on her way to the Italian lakes to join an aunt, some friends, a lover. Now Goldfinger was on his feet. Tidy man. That's right, pick up the scraps of paper and tuck them away carefully under the bridge. Why not throw them in the stream? Suddenly Bond's jaws tightened. What did those actions of Goldfinger remind him of? Was Bond romancing again, or was the bridge a postbox? Had Goldfinger been instructed to leave something, one of his bars of gold, under this particular bridge? France, Switzerland, Italy. It was convenient for all of them. The communist cell in Lyon, for instance, one of the strongest in France, and this was a good place to use, with a clear field of view up and down the road. Goldfinger scrambled out the bank. Bond drew back under cover. He heard the distant grind of the old self-starter. He cautiously watched the rolls until it had disappeared. It was a pretty bridge over a pretty stream. It had a survey number set in the arch, 79/6, the sixth bridge from some town on N79. Easy to find. Bond got quickly out of the car and slid down the shallow bank. It was dark and cool under the arch. There were the shadows of fish in the slow, clear, pebbled water. Bond searched the edge of the masonry near the grass verge. Exactly in the centre, below the road, there was a patch of thick grass against the wall. Bond parted the grass. There was a sprinkling of freshly turned earth. Bond dug with his fingers. There was only one. It was smooth to the touch and brick-shaped. It needed some strength to lift it. Bond brushed the earth off the dull yellow metal and wrapped the heavy bar in his handkerchief. He held the bar under his coat and climbed back up the bank onto the empty road.
Chapter 13. If You Touch Me There.
Bond felt pleased with himself. A whole lot of people were going to get very angry with Goldfinger. You can do a lot of dirty work with £20,000. Now plans would have to be altered, conspiracies postponed, perhaps even lives saved. And if it ever got to an inquiry by Smersh, which was unlikely as they were the sort of realistic people who cut their losses, it could only be assumed that some sheltering tramp had found the gold bar. Bond lifted the secret flap under the passenger seat and slipped the bar inside. Dangerous stuff. He would have to contact the next station of the service and hand it over to them. They would get it back to London in the embassy bag. Bond would have to report this quickly. It confirmed a lot. M might even want to warn the deuxième and have the bridge watched to see who came. But Bond hoped that would not happen. He didn't want a scare started just when he was getting close to Goldfinger. He wanted the skies over Goldfinger to be blue and clear. Bond got moving. Now there were other things to think about. He must catch up with the Rolls before Macon and get the next fork to Geneva or Lyon right. He must solve the problem of the girl and, if possible, get her off the road. Pretty or not, she was confusing the issue. And he must stop and buy himself something to eat and drink. It was 1 o'clock, and the sight of Goldfinger eating had made him hungry. And it was time to fill up and check the water and oil. The drone of the Homer grew louder. He was in the outskirts of Macon. He must close up and take the risk of being spotted. The busy traffic would hide his low-slung car. It was vital to know if the Rolls crossed the Seine for the Bourg Road, or if it turned right at the bridge and joined the N6 for Lyon. Far down the Rue Rambuteau there was a glimpse of yellow. Over the railway bridge, and through the little square, the high yellow box kept on towards the river. Bond watched the passers-by turn their heads to follow the gleaming Rolls. The river. Would Goldfinger turn right or keep on across the bridge? The Rolls kept straight on. So it was Switzerland. Bond followed over into the suburb of Saint-Laurent, now for a butcher and a baker and a wine shop. 100 yards ahead, the golden head of a calf hung over the pavement. Bond glanced in his driving mirror. Well, well. The little triumph was only feet away from his tail. How long had she been there? Bond had been so intent on following the Rolls that he hadn't glanced back since entering the town. She must have been hiding up a side street. So, now coincidence was certainly out. Something must be done. Sorry, sweetheart. I've got to mess you up. I'll be as gentle as I can. Hold tight. Bond stopped abruptly in front of the butcher's shop. He banged the gears into reverse. There was a sickening scrunch and tinkle. Bond switched off his engine and got out. He walked round to the back of the car. The girl, her face tense with anger, had one beautiful silken leg on the road. There was an indiscreet glimpse of white thigh. The girl stripped off her goggles and stood legs braced and arms akimbo. The beautiful mouth was taut with anger. The Aston Martin's rear bumper was locked into the wreckage of the Triumph's lamps and radiator grill. Bond said amiably, "If you touch me there again, you'll have to marry me." The words were hardly out of his mouth before the open palm cracked across his face. Bond put up a hand and rubbed his cheek. Now there was quite a crowd. There was a murmur of approval and ribaldry.
"Allez, la gosse, maintenant le knockout!"
The girl's rage had not dissipated with the blow.
"You bloody fool! What the hell do you think you're doing?"
Bond thought, if only pretty girls were always angry, they would be beautiful. He said, "Your brakes can't be up to much."
"My brakes? What the hell do you mean? You reversed into me."
"Gears slipped. I didn't know you were so close." It was time to calm her down. "I'm most frightfully sorry. I'll pay for all the repairs and everything. It really is bad luck. Let's see what the damage is. Try and back away. Doesn't look as if our bumpers have overridden." Bond put a foot on the Triumph's bumpers and rocked.
"Don't you dare touch my car! Leave it alone!"
Angrily, the girl climbed back into the driver's seat. She pressed the self-starter. The engine fired. Metal clanged under the bonnet. She switched off and leant out.
"There you are, you idiot! You've smashed the fan!"
Bond had hoped he had. He got into his own car and eased it away from the Triumph. Bits of the Triumph, released by Bond's bumper, tinkled onto the road. He got out again. The crowd had thinned. There was a man in a mechanic's overalls. He volunteered to call a breakdown van and went off to do so. Bond walked over to the Triumph. The girl had got out and was waiting for him. Her expression had changed. Now she was more composed. Bond noticed that her eyes, which were dark blue, watched his face carefully. Bond said, "It really won't be too bad. Probably knocked the fan out of alignment. They'll put temporary headlamps in the sockets and straighten up the chrome. You'll be off again by tomorrow morning. Now," Bond reached into his pocket for his note-case, "this is maddening for you, and I'll certainly take all the blame. Here's 100,000 francs to cover the damage and your expenses for the night, and telephoning your friends and so on. Please take it and call it quits. I'd love to stay here and see you get on the road all right tomorrow morning, but I've got an appointment this evening, and I've simply got to make it."
"No."
The one word was cool, definite. The girl put her hands behind her back and waited. But what was it she wanted? The police? Have him charged with dangerous driving?
"I've got an appointment this evening, too. I've got to make it. I've got to get to Geneva. Will you please take me there? It's not far, only about 100 miles. We could do it in 2 hours in that."
She gestured at the DB3.
"Will you? Please?"
There was a desperate urgency in the voice. No cajolery, no threats, only a blazing need. For the first time, Bond examined her as more than a pretty girl who, perhaps, they were the only explanations Bond had found to fit the facts, wanted to be picked up by Goldfinger, or had a blackmail on him. But she didn't look capable of either of these things. There was too much character in the face, too much candour, and she wasn't wearing the uniform of a seductress. She wore a white, rather masculine-cut, heavy silk shirt. It was open at the neck, but it would button up to a narrow military collar. The shirt had long, wide sleeves gathered at the wrists. The girl's nails were unpainted, and her only piece of jewellery was a gold ring on her engagement finger. True or false? She wore a very wide black-stitched leather belt with double brass buckles. It rose at the back to give some of the support of a racing driver's corset belt. Her short skirt was charcoal grey and pleated. Her shoes were expensive-looking black sandals, which would be comfortable and cool for driving. The only touch of colour was the pink handkerchief which she had taken off her head and now held by her side with the white goggles. It all looked very attractive. But the get-up reminded Bond more of an equipment than a young girl's dress. There was something faintly mannish and open-air about the whole of her behaviour and appearance. She might, thought Bond, be a member of the English women's ski team, or spend a lot of her time in England hunting or show-jumping. Although she was a very beautiful girl, she was the kind who leaves her beauty alone. She had made no attempt to pat her hair into place. As a result, it looked as a girl's hair should look, untidy with bits that strayed and a rather crooked parting. It provided the contrast of an uneven, jagged, dark frame for the pale symmetry of the face, the main features of which were blue eyes under dark brows, a desirable mouth, and an air of determination and independence that came from the high cheekbones and the fine line of the jaw. There was the same air of self-reliance in her figure. She held her body proudly, her fine breasts outthrown and unashamed under the taut silk. Her stance, with feet slightly parted and hands behind her back, was a mixture of provocation and challenge. The whole picture seemed to say, "Now then, you handsome bastard, don't think you can little woman me. You've got me into this mess, and by God you're going to get me out. You may be attractive, but I've got my life to run, and I know where I'm going." Bond weighed her request. How much of a nuisance would she be? How soon could he get rid of her and get on with his business? Was there any security risk? Against the disadvantages, there was his curiosity about her and what she was up to, the memory of the fable he had spun round her, and which had now taken its first step towards realization, and finally, the damsel in distress business, any woman's appeal for help. Bond said curtly, "I'll be glad to take you to Geneva. Now then," he opened up the back of the Aston Martin, "let's get your things in. While I fix up about the garage, here's some money. Please buy us lunch, anything you like for yourself. For me, 6 inches of Lyon sausage, a loaf of bread, butter, and half a litre of Macon with the cork pulled." Their eyes met and exchanged a flurry of masculine-feminine-master-slave signals. The girl took the money.
"Thank you. I'll get the same things for myself."
She went to the boot of the Triumph and unlocked it.
"No, don't bother. I can manage these."
She hauled out a bag of golf clubs with the cover zipped shut and a small, expensive-looking suitcase. She brought them over to the Aston Martin and, rejecting Bond's offer of help, fitted them in alongside Bond's suitcase. She watched him lock the back of the car and went back to the Triumph. She took out a wide, black-stitched leather shoulder bag. Bond said, "What name and address shall I give?"
"What?"
Bond repeated his question, wondering if she would lie about the name or the address, or both. She said,
"I shall be moving about. Better say the Berg at Geneva. The name's Soames. Miss Tilly Soames."
There was no hesitation. She went into the butcher's shop. A quarter of an hour later, they were on their way. The girl sat upright and kept her eyes on the road. The drone on the Homer was faint. The Rolls must have gained 50 miles. Bond hurried. They flashed through Bourg and over the river at Pont d'En. Now they were in the foothills of the Jura, and there were the S-bends of N-84. Bond went at them as if he was competing in the Alpine trials. After the girl had swayed against him twice, she kept her hand on the handle on the dash and rode with the car as if she were his spare driver. Once, after a particularly sharp, dry skid that almost took them over the side, Bond glanced at her profile. Her lips were parted and her nostrils slightly flared. The eyes were alight. She was enjoying herself. They came to the top of the pass, and there was the run down towards the Swiss frontier. Now the Homer was sending out a steady howl. Bond thought, "I must take it easy, or we shall be running into them at the customs." He put his hand under the dash and tuned the noise down. He pulled into the side of the road. They sat in the car and ate a polite but almost silent picnic, neither making any attempt at conversation. Both, it seemed, with other things on their minds. After 10 minutes, Bond got going again. He sat relaxed, motoring easily down the curving road through the young, whispering pines. The girl said,
"What's that noise?"
"Magneto whine. Gets worse when I hurry. Started at Orléans. Have to get it fixed tonight." She seemed satisfied with this mumbo-jumbo. She said diffidently,
"Where are you heading for? I hope I haven't taken you very far out of your way."
Bond said in a friendly voice, "Not at all. As a matter of fact, I'm going to Geneva, too, but I may not stop there tonight. May have to get on. Depends on my meeting. How long will you be there?"
"I don't know. I'm playing golf. There's the Swiss Women's Open Championship at Divonne. I'm not really that class, but I thought it would be good for me to try. Then I was going to play on some of the other courses."
Fair enough. No reason why it shouldn't be true. But Bond was certain it wasn't the whole truth. He said, "Do you play a lot of golf? What's your home course?"
This book is continued on Disc 5.